Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this special episode, we sat down with Dr. Benjamin Tolchin, director for the Center of Clinical Ethics at Yale New Haven Health, to discuss the recently published American Academy of Neurology guidelines regarding functional seizures. Tolchin, who serves as an associate professor of neurology at Yale University, walked through the key drivers behind the guideline development, best practices for diagnosis, and the importance of identifying co-occurring psychiatric conditions and epilepsy. Furthermore, Tolchin reviewed the evidence supporting psychological and pharmacological interventions, highlighted critical gaps that remain in research, and future directions for understanding pathophysiology and treatment for functional seizures. Let's dive in.
You know, I think there is an awareness that there are many patients with functional seizures and other functional neurologic disorders that has been there's been greater and greater awareness of this issue among clinicians. And at the same time, there has been a growing body of evidence about what is effective in treatment and different types of psychological interventions that can be effective for treatment. We've been thinking about this guideline since, 2014, 2015. Originally, I think that there was concern that there were a couple of randomized trials, but there wasn't a group. When you're developing a guideline like this, you want to see evidence not just from like one randomized trial, but from multiple randomized trials. And I think over the 20 teens into 2020, there was a completion of multiple randomized trials of different psychological interventions, and I think that that buildup of higher quality evidence, over the course of 5 to 7 years, I think really made it clear that it was time for a guideline. At the same time, I think there's a lot of interest in the area from clinicians, from patients, families, and advocates, and a growing clamor for greater guidance because there is so much variability in diagnosis and treatment. And, there was, I think, a lot of interest in an overview of sort of what is the best evidence that we have.
Yeah, obviously, like you said, when you go 5, 6, 7 years, the evidence kind of builds up from that point and there's enough to work off of that. Maybe it might be time to take a look at what we have and make some recommendations. So, obviously, Dr. Tolchin, there's several different parts to these recommendations. And the first thing that you kind of led off with was the diagnosis of functional seizures. So, for our clinical audience, outline some of the rationale within these recommendations in this section and what clinicians should be aware of during the diagnostic process of functional seizures.
So in terms of diagnosis, a few points that are made in the recommendations. First, really, that the diagnosis begins with the history and semiology. So the history of the patient's illness, how their events have developed, whether there are co-occurring issues, either psychiatric or medical, and then the semiology, what the seizure episodes look and feel like. And I think one of the points we highlight in the diagnostic section is the importance of getting as much information about this history and semiology as possible. So interviewing the patient, but also, if possible, interviewing eyewitnesses, family, friends who may have observed seizures and may be familiar with the patient's history. And then also, if possible, obtaining smartphone videos. We are fortunate to live in a world where smartphones are everywhere. And so we really recommend, if possible, getting an actual video of a typical seizure episode, even, before the patient comes into, a video EEG for review by a neurologist with experience in diagnosing the seizure episodes. That can be very helpful in getting a sense of what the most likely diagnosis is. It may not be the highest level of clinical certainty, but it is very helpful in informing the diagnostic workup. And then we recommend obtaining additional information to make the diagnosis with the greatest possible level of clinical certainty. And that may involve obtaining a video EEG in addition to that historical and semiological data. Certainly, an interictal EEG is very strongly recommended, and clinicians may consider an extended video EEG with capture of typical episodes to make the diagnosis with the greatest possible clinical certainty. And that can be very helpful both in terms of making the diagnosis and also in terms of providing both the patient, the family, and clinicians comfort during the therapeutic process, during the treatment process, that we have a very clear sense of what is going on here and what isn't going on.
So obviously, you talked about some of the psychiatric aspects about this disorder and disease. So focusing in on the assessment of psychiatric comorbidities and epilepsy provides some insights on the history of psychiatric disorders in this population and how clinicians should be approaching these issues in patients.
Yeah, so I think evaluating comorbidities or co-occurring disorders is a really important part of the initial workup. You know, there are studies that show that up to 90% of patients with functional neurologic disorders may have co-occurring psychiatric disorders, and those can range from, you know, depression and anxiety, maybe most common, but more severe psychiatric illness can occur, including PTSD, bipolar disorder. And so I think it's very important to, at a minimum, screen for co-occurring psychiatric disorders, if it is at all possible. I think, you know, referring patients for evaluation, you know, by a psychiatrist, either on the inpatient side while they're having an EEG workup, or as an outpatient in a psychiatric clinic, can be very helpful in terms of establishing what other psychiatric illnesses may be present. And that can be very important for facilitating treatment of the functional seizures. It's a lot easier to provide psychotherapy to treat functional seizures when a patient's co-occurring depression and anxiety has been adequately treated. Active, untreated psychiatric comorbidities can really make the whole treatment process of the functional seizures much more complex and much more difficult. And so I think it is really valuable, if at all possible, to have a formal psychiatric evaluation and appropriate psychopharmacologic and psychotherapeutic treatment of any comorbidities. In terms of the epilepsy, you know, that's another reason for careful EEG workup, whether that's interictal EEGs or even an extended video EEG to capture all of the typical episodes. Because as we discuss in the guideline, systematic reviews show that, you know, 20 to 22% of patients with functional seizures will also have epileptic seizures. And so you want to have a sense of, you know, whether that's the case in the particular patient you're treating. That's going to be an important factor when you're thinking about treatment. Does this patient need to be on anti-seizure medications in addition to going through psychotherapy? If the patient has a seizure, is it a functional seizure that warrants psychotherapeutic treatment, or is it an epileptic seizure that warrants up titration of an anti-seizure medication? So it's really helpful when you're evaluating these patients to, first of all, be very clear whether they have co-occurring epilepsy, and if they do, to have a very clear sense of what the epileptic seizures look like and how they differ from the functional seizures.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Tolchin to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on January 12th, the FDA approved Sentyl Therapeutics' copper histidinine as the first treatment for pediatric patients with Menkes disease, a rare genetic neurodegenerative disorder. Marketed as Zycubo, the therapy is a subcutaneous copper replacement therapy designed to bypass intestinal absorption and support systemic utilization of the mineral. Next, on the same day, the FDA accepted Argenx supplemental biologics license application for efgartigimod as a treatment of seronegative generalized myasthenia gravis, a subgroup of patients affecting 15% of GMG. As part of the decision, the FDA granted a PDUFA target action date of May 10, 2026 for final decision. And lastly, a few days later, the European Commission granted marketing authorization for a high-dose, potentially more efficacious regimen of nusinersen for patients with 5q spinal muscular atrophy. The newly approved high-dose regimen includes a more rapid loading phase consisting of two 50 mg loading doses administered 14 days apart, followed by a 28 mg maintenance dose every 4 months thereafter. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Tolchin.
It's interesting. Obviously, the small differences do matter a lot in these cases, for sure. So definitely getting all of that diagnostic workup is definitely important in understanding what comorbidities we're kind of dealing with and how we can potentially approach it. Kind of stemming from that topic, talk a little bit about some of the actual psychological interventions that we do have at our disposal, you know, just what their role is in this patient population and when they are appropriate to use in patients with functional seizures.
So, I mean, I think one of the really key findings from the systematic review that we conducted is that psychological interventions can be effective in achieving freedom from functional seizures, in reducing the frequency of functional seizures, in improving quality of life for patients with functional seizures, and in decreasing anxiety for patients with functional seizures. And that was shown, you know, on a systematic review across multiple randomized trials. So I think that's a really important key finding. And based on that finding, you know, we recommend that the risks and benefits of psychological interventions should be discussed with patients diagnosed with functional seizures and for appropriate patients who are interested in psychotherapeutic treatment, they should be referred for psychotherapeutic treatment. Now, in terms of like the specific modalities of psychotherapy, so we looked at a number of different randomized trials of interventions, including cognitive behavioral therapy for functional seizures, neurobehavioral therapy for functional seizures, REACT, which is a cognitive behavioral therapy informed regimen specifically developed for children or pediatric patients with functional seizures. We also looked at motivational interviewing as a psychological treatment for functional seizures, as well as a number of other psychological treatments. I think one important issue is that the majority of psychological interventions that we were looking at were specifically tailored to functional seizures. So we're not just talking about any cognitive behavioral therapy. We're talking about a cognitive behavioral therapy regimen that was specifically tailored to the treatment of functional seizures. And neurobehavioral therapy, similarly, is specifically tailored to the treatment of functional seizures. And so I think if that is available, we would recommend referral to a provider of psychological treatment and specifically a psychological treatment tailored to functional seizures. We are fortunate now to have, you know, published regimens. The neurobehavioral therapy is available, for example, in a published regimen. It can be bought on, you know, Amazon or in a major bookstores or book websites. And our hope is that other psychotherapeutic regimens will be published and sort of widely publicly available in the near future.
It's very, very interesting. And obviously, you know, this has definitely been an area that's expanded a lot over the last 5-10 years or so. And, you know, even the psychiatric aspects have definitely become less siloed away from neurology and kind of a little bit more intertwined together a little bit more. So kind of switching gears to more of the pharmacological interventions, which obviously we do have several pharmacological interventions available. What did some the evidence show about these therapies to treat functional seizures? And how did that sort of influence your recommendations in these guidelines?
So unfortunately, there really is very limited evidence relating to the treatment of functional seizures with psychopharmacologic medications. Some of the limited evidence deals with SSRIs and sertraline and benzodiazepines. And the short of our review of that evidence is that there really is not evidence of benefit in the treatment of functional seizures with any of these medications. Now, I will caveat that and say that the evidence at this point is limited. This is definitely an area that requires, you know, further study. But I think at this point we can, the evidence that we have available is sufficient to warrant a recommendation that anti-seizure medications, including benzodiazepines, should not be initiated for the treatment of functional seizures. And if a patient is taking these medications and there is not an additional indication for that medication, such as co-occurring epilepsy or migraine headaches or a co-occurring psychiatric disorder that can be treated with that medication, we recommend informing patients of the risks and the lack of evidence of benefit associated with those medications for the treatment of functional seizures. And we recommend titrating those medications off unless there is an additional indication for those medications. I think this is like particularly important with relation to benzodiazepines. We see a lot of patients with functional seizures who are treated with benzodiazepines. And now this is not based on the systematic review. This is based on clinical experience. I would say that, you know, benzodiazepines can be very effective in the short term because they are anxiolytics. And so they can, in the short term, abort functional seizures. And that can make patients, families, and clinicians very interested in benzodiazepines because of this short-term benefit. Unfortunately, because of habituation over the long term, benzodiazepines often become less effective when used frequently over long periods of time, and they are associated with a number of serious adverse effects, including cognitive impairment, including the possibility of withdrawal and even withdrawal seizures. So there are a number of reasons why we recommend against the use of benzodiazepines for the treatment of functional seizures. That's not to say that a patient who has functional seizures cannot be on benzodiazepines. Certainly, if they have another indication for the benzodiazepines, for example, an anxiety disorder that is being treated by a psychiatrist with benzodiazepines, that might be quite reasonable and appropriate. But the specific recommendation is that the functional seizures themselves should not be treated with benzodiazepines or other anti-seizure medications.
Obviously, a lot to weigh, especially with some of the side effect profiles, which unfortunately, you know, these things have kind of been like this for quite some time now. Dr. Tolchin, I'm curious from your perspective, you know, how do we kind of break the barrier, and how do we kind of get more clinical trials up and running for functional seizures, considering that we don't have a lot of, you know, very tried and true therapies for this disorder? So how do we kind of break through a little bit?
Yeah, so I think one thing that would be enormously helpful would be further study of the underlying pathophysiologies. I think having a better understanding of the underlying neurophysiology that causes functional seizures, I think that could be helpful both for researchers in terms of like guiding different treatment modalities, perhaps including pharmacologic or neurostimulatory treatment modalities. I think it would also be very helpful for clinicians and patients in terms of potentially differentiating different subtypes of functional seizures. One concern that I have as a clinician and researcher is that functional seizures may be a little bit of an umbrella category, overarching like multiple different subtypes that we haven't really been able to clearly differentiate from each other. And I think that both for clinicians and for patients and families, having a clearer understanding of what specifically is causing their functional seizures could be very helpful. You know, in terms of psychotherapeutic treatments. I think we have some great studies showing that psychological interventions are effective or are potentially effective in the treatment of functional seizures. But we're lacking in a number of things like comparative studies, head-to-head comparisons between different psychological modalities. So we know we have, you know, randomized trials in cognitive behavioral therapy. We have randomized trials in neurobehavioral therapy. We have randomized trials in REACT and motivational interviewing. But there isn't head-to-head comparison showing that one psychological intervention is more effective than others or is more effective for a specific population of patients with functional seizures. Another area that's really lacking is studies of long-term benefits. So like 1 year out from psychological treatment, how effective, how sustained are the benefits? Another area that's really lacking is for those patients who don't respond to a first-line psychological treatment, are there specific psychological treatments that should be considered as second or third line as alternatives? Also, given technological developments, you know, we're seeing a growth of teletherapy and even artificial intelligence aided therapy, and we really are lacking in evidence, lacking in high quality randomized controlled trial evidence for teletherapy and AI aided therapy for functional seizures. I think these are areas where further research is badly needed.
Dr. Tolshin, appreciate you taking some time out of your day and lending a lot of great clinical insights. Last question for you is just, we kind of just talked about it a little bit, but you know, what suggestions would you recommend for future research, and what areas of focus should the clinical community be spending more time towards to hopefully solve some more of the puzzle for functional seizures?
Yeah, I mean, I think besides the underlying pathophysiology, which we spoke about, and some of the additional the head-to-head comparisons, the long-term outcomes, you know, I think other areas that really warrant a lot of additional research would be further studies of psychopharmacologic treatment, particularly as adjuncts to psychotherapy. So if we know that specific modalities of psychotherapy are effective, might they be more effective in conjunction with a psychopharmacologic medication such as an SSRI or SNRI? Neurostimulation is an area where there have been some early pilot studies, but there has not been, you know, robust randomized trials. I think is really warranted. And then there are a whole host of psychotherapeutic modalities such as EMDR, where there are initial very positive results from observational studies, but very limited evidence from randomized clinical trials. And I think that would be terrific areas. I will say, you know, this is the first guideline from the American Academy of Neurology on any functional neurologic disorder. It's a first step. It is by no means the final step. I hope that there will be future guidelines, both in terms of functional movement disorders and also follow-ups to this guideline coming back in a few years once further study has been undertaken that will give even greater guidance to, you know, clinicians, patients, and families.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.